she'd know that, was saying, "Now, you must call this lady Aunt Rose, and she will be kind to you." It was in that moment that she first heard the voice. When she looked up into Aunt Rose's face, and the voice said, "Kind? Sure. Uh-huh. I don't think so." The voice has never steered her wrong since then. Aunt Rose turned out to be a mean old lady who'd call Allie bad names when she had a little to drink, and she liked to drink most every day. The voice told Allie what to do, how to pick the right teacher at school, and tell the story in such a way that she didn't seem to be saying it artfully at all. But the lady after Aunt Rose was even worse, and Mrs. Montgomery Taylor was worse than that. Still, the voice has kept her safe from the worst harm all these years. She still has all her fingers and toes, though that's been a near-run thing. And now it's telling her, "Stay here. Wait for it." She walks into town every day and explores every place that's warm and dry and where they don't throw her out. The library, the church, the little overheated museum of the Revolutionary War. And on the third day, she manages to sneak into the aquarium. It's off-season. No one's minding the door so hard, and it's only a small place anyway. 5 rooms strung together at the end of a line of stores. "Wonders of the deep," says the sign outside. Allie waits until the guy on the door has wandered off to get a soda, leaving a "back in 20 minutes" sign, and she flips open the little wooden door and walks straight in. Because it's warm, really. And because the voice told her to look everywhere. No stone unturned. She can feel there's something here for her as soon as she walks into the room full of brightly lit tanks with fish of 100 coloured kinds patrolling the water back and forth. She feels it across her chest, in her collarbone, down to her fingers. There's something here. Another girl who can do the thing she can do. No, not a girl. Allie feels out again with that other sense, the one that tingles. She's seen a little bit about it online. Other girls saying they can sense if another woman in the room is about to discharge her power. But no one has it like Allie has it. Since she first got her power, she's been able to tell at once if anyone around her had any at all. And there's something here. She finds it in the last tank but one, a darker tank than the rest, without the coloured, garlanded and fronded fish. It contains long, dark and sinuous creatures waiting at the bottom of the tank, stirring slowly. There's a meter box to one side of the tank with its needle at zero. Allie has never seen them before, nor does she know their name. She puts her hand to the glass. One of the eels shifts, turns and does something. She can hear it. A fizzing, cracking sound. The needle on the meter jumps. But Allie doesn't need to know what the box is, to know what just happened. This fish made a jolt. There's a board up on the wall next to the tank. It's so exciting that she has to read it 3 times and keep herself under control or her breathing goes fast. "These are electric eels. They can do crazy things. They give shocks to their prey underwater." Yeah, that's right. Allie makes a little arc between her finger and thumb under the table. The eels stir in the tank. That's not all electric eels can do. They can remote control the muscles in their prey by interfering with the electric signals in the brain. They can make those fish swim straight into their mouths if they want to. Allie stands for a long time with that. She puts her hand back on the glass. She looks at the animals. "That is a mighty power indeed. You would have to have control. Why? But you've always had control, daughter. And you'd have to be skillful. Why? But you can learn those skills. Allie says in her heart, Mother, where shall I go? And the voice says, Leave this place and go from here to the place that I shall show you. The voice always did have a biblical way with it, just like that. That night, Allie wants to settle to sleeping, but the voice says, No, go on walking. Keep on. Her stomach is so empty, and she feels peculiar, light-headed, troubled in her mind with thoughts of Mr. Montgomery Taylor, as if his lolling tongue was still licking at her ear. She wishes she had a dog. The voice says, Nearly there, my girl. Don't you worry. And out of the darkness, Allie sees a light, illuminating a sign. It says, Sisters of Mercy Convent, soup for the homeless and beds for those in need. The voice says, See, I told you. And all Allie knows after she crosses the threshold is that three women take her up bodily, calling her child and sweet, and exclaiming when they find the crucifix in her bag, because this is the proof of what they'd hoped to find in her face. They bring the food to her while she sits up, barely conscious, in a soft, warm bed. And that night, not a one of them asked who she was and where she'd come from. There is very little attention paid to a mixed-race child, with no home and no family, washed up at a convent on the eastern seaboard in those months. She is not the only girl who beaches on this shore. Nor is she the one most in need of counsel. The sisters are glad to find a use for the empty bedrooms. They are living in a building too large for them, built almost 100 years ago, when the Lord was still calling women by the fistful to his eternal marriage. By the time 3 months have passed, they have put in bunk beds and tacked up a schedule of classes and Sunday school and given out chores in exchange for meals and comforters and a roof over the head. There has been a great tide in the movement of people, and those old ways have taken precedence again. Girls thrown out onto the street, the nuns will take them in. Allie likes to get the stories out of the other girls. She becomes a confidant, a pal, to several of them, so she can match her tale up to theirs. There's Savannah, who struck her stepbrother across the face so hard, she says, that Spider's webs grew on him. They grew right over his mouth and his nose and even his eyes. Savannah tells this story wide-eyed, chewing her gum enthusiastically. Allie digs her fork into the tough old stewing meat the nuns serve for dinner thrice weekly. She says, What are you gonna do now? And Savannah says, I'm gonna find a doctor who'll take it out of me. Cut that thing right out. A clue. There are others. Some of the girls were prayed over by parents who thought a demon had possessed them. Some fought with other girls. Some are still fighting here. One had done the thing to a boy because he asked her to. This story holds much interest for the girls. Could it be that boys like it? Is it possible they want it? Some of them have found internet forums that suggest that this is the case. There's one girl, Victoria, who showed her mother how to do the thing. Her mother, who Victoria says as simply as if she were talking about the weather, had been beaten so hard and so often by Victoria's stepdad that she hasn't a tooth left in her head. Victoria woke the power up in her with a touch of her hand and showed her how to use it. And her mother threw her out into the street, calling her a witch. None of them needs an internet forum to understand that. They all nod, and someone passes Victoria the jug of gravy. In a less chaotic time, there might have been police or social services or earnest folk from the school board asking what was going on with these girls. But the authorities are simply grateful that someone is helping them out. Someone asks Allie what happened to her, and she knows she can't give her real name. She calls herself Eve, and the voice says, "Good choice. The first of women. Excellent choice." Eve's story is simple. Not interesting enough to be remembered. Eve's from Augusta, and her parents sent her to relatives for 2 weeks. And when she came back, they'd moved away. She doesn't know where. She had 2 younger brothers. Her parents were scared for them, she thinks, although she'd never hurt no one. The other girls nod and move on to someone else. "It's not what I've done," Allie thinks to herself. "It's what I'm going to do." And the voice says, "It's what Eve's going to do." And Allie says, "Yes." She likes it in the convent. The nuns, for the most part, are kind, and the company of women is pleasing to Allie. She's not found the company of men has had much to recommend it. The girls have chores to complete, but when they're done, there's the ocean for swimming and the beach for walking. There are swings out back, and the singing in chapel is peaceful and quiets all the voices in Allie's head. She finds herself thinking in those quiet times, "Maybe I could stay here forever. To dwell in the house of God all the days of my life is my one request." There is one nun, Sister Maria Ignatia, who particularly draws Allie's attention. She has dark skin like Allie herself, and soft brown eyes. Sister Maria Ignatia likes to tell stories of the childhood of Jesus, and of how his mother, Mary, was always kind to him and taught him to love all living things. "See," Sister Maria Ignatia says to the girls who gather to listen to her before evensong, "our Lord learned from a woman how to love, and Mary is close to all children. She is close to you now and has brought you to our door." One evening, after the others have gone, Allie leans her head against Sister Maria Ignatia's knee and says, "Can I live here all my life?" Sister Maria Ignatia strokes her hair and says, "Oh, you would have to become a nun to stay here. And you might decide you want other things from your life. A husband and children? A job?" Allie thinks, this is always the answer. They never want you to stay forever. They always say they love you, but they never want you to stay. And the voice says, very quietly, "Daughter, if you want to stay, I can fix that for you." Allie says to the voice, "Are you Mary, the mother?" And the voice says, "If you like, my dear, if that's what floats your boat." Allie says, "They never want to keep me, though, do they? I never get to stay." And the voice says, "If you want to stay, you'll have to make this place your own. Think about how to do that. Don't worry. You'll figure it out." The girls play at fighting, trying out their skills on each other. In the water, on the land, giving each other little jolts and thrills. Allie uses that time to practice too, although she's more subtle about it. She doesn't want them to know what she's doing, remembering the thing she read about the electric eels. She manages, after a long time, to send out a tiny jolt that will make one of the other girl's arm or leg jump. "Ow!" says Savannah, as her shoulder flies upwards. "Someone walk over my grave." "Ha!" says Victoria, as Allie jangles her brain a little. "I have a headache. I can't think straight." "Fuck!" shouts Abigail as her knees buckle. "Got a fucking cramp from the water." It doesn't take much power to do it. And it doesn't hurt them. They never know it was Allie. Like the eels in the tank, her head just above the waterline, her eyes wide and steady. After a few months, Some of the other girls start to talk about moving on from the convent. It's occurred to Ally, or Eve as she's trying to think of herself, even in private, that some of the others might have secrets too. Might also be hiding here until the heat dies down. One of the girls, they call her Gordy because her surname's Gordon, asks Ally to come with her. "We're going to Baltimore," she says. "My mom's family has people there. They'll help us get set up." She shifts her shoulders. "I'd like your company along the way." Eve has made friends, in a way Ally has always found difficult. Eve is kind and quiet and watchful, where Ally was spiky and complicated. She cannot go back to where she came from. And what indeed would there be to return for? But there will be no great hunt for her. She looks different now, anyway. Her face longer and leaner, her frame taller. It is that time in life when children start to wear their adult faces. She could walk north to Baltimore, or move on to some other nowhere town and take a job as a waitress. In 3 years' time, no one back in Jacksonville would know her for certain. Or she could stay here. When Gordy says,
"Come away,"
Ally knows she wants to stay. She is happier here than she has ever been. She listens at doors and around corners. She has always had this habit. A child in danger must learn to pay more attention to the adults than a child loved and cherished. That is how she hears the nuns arguing between themselves, and how she learns she might not have the chance to stay at all. It is Sister Veronica, her face like granite, whose voice Ally hears through the door of their small sitting room.
"Have you seen it?"
she is saying.
"Have you seen it working?"
"We have all seen it," rumbles the abbess.
"Then how can you doubt what it is?"
"Fairy stories," says Sister Maria Ignatia. "Children's games." Sister Veronica's voice is so loud it makes the door tremble a little, and Ally takes a pace back.
"Are the Gospels themselves fairy tales? Was our Lord a liar? Do you tell me that there has never been a demon, that when he cast out devils from men, he was playing a game?"
"No one is saying that, Veronica. No one is doubting the Gospels."
"Have you seen it on the news reports? Have you seen what they do? They have powers that men are not meant to know. From where does this power come? We all know the answer. The Lord told us where these powers come from. We all know."
There is a silence in the room. Sister Maria Ignatia speaks softly.
"I have heard that it is caused by pollution. There was an interesting piece in the newspaper. Pollution in the atmosphere, causing certain mutations in the..."
"It is the devil! The devil walks abroad and tests the innocent and the guilty, giving powers to the damned as he has always done."
"Oh, no," says Sister Maria Ignatia. "I have seen the good in their faces. They are children. We have a duty to care for them."
"You would see good in the face of Satan himself if he arrived at your door with a pitiful story and a hungry belly."
"And would I be so wrong to do so, if Satan needed feeding?"
Sister Veronica gives a laugh like a dog's bark.
Good intentions pave the road to hell."
The abbess speaks over them all.
"We have already asked for guidance to the diocesan council. They are praying on it. In the meantime, the Lord told us to suffer the little children. Younger girls awaken it in older women. This is the devil working in the world, passing from hand to hand as Eve passed the apple to Adam."
"We cannot simply throw children out onto the street."
"The devil will gather them to his bosom."
"Or they will starve," says Sister Maria Ignatia.
Ally thinks it over for a long time. She could move on. But she likes it here. The voice says,
"You heard what she said. Eve passed the apple to Adam."
Ally thinks, maybe she was right to do it. Maybe that's what the world needed. A bit of shaking up. Something new.
The voice says,
"That's my girl."
Allie thinks, "Are you God?"
The voice says, "Who do you say that I am?"
Allie thinks, "I know that you speak to me in my hour of need. I know that you have guided me on the true path. Tell me what to do now. Tell me."
The voice says, "If the world didn't need shaken up, why would this power have come alive now?"
Allie thinks, "God is telling the world that there is to be a new order, that the old way is overturned, the old centuries are done. Just as Jesus told the people of Israel that God's desires had changed, the time of the Gospels is over, and there must be a new doctrine."
The voice says, "There is a need for a prophet in the land."
Allie thinks, "But who?"
The voice says, "Just try it on for size, honey. Remember, if you're going to stay here, you're going to need to own the place so they can't take it from you. The only way you're safe, honey bun, is if you own it."
Roxy. Roxy's seen her dad hit blokes before. She's seen him hit them square in the face with all his rings on, casual, just as he was turning to leave. She's seen him punch a bloke till his nose was bleeding and he fell to the floor, and Bernie kicked him in the stomach again and again. And when he was finished, he wiped his hands on the handkerchief from his back pocket and looked down at the mess of the bloke's face and said, "Don't you fuck with me. Don't you think you can fuck with me?" She's always wanted that. Her dad's body is a castle for her, a shelter and a weapon. When he puts his arms around her shoulders, she feels a mixture of terror and comfort. She's run up the stairs from his fist, screaming. She's seen how he hurts people who want to hurt her. She's always wanted to have that. It's the only thing worth having.
"You know what's happened, don't you, darling?"
says Bernie.
"Fucking Primrose," says Ricky. Ricky's the oldest of her half-brothers. Bernie says,
"It was a declaration of war. Killing your mum, darling. And it's taken us a long time to be sure we can get him. But now we're sure. And we're ready."
There's a look that passes around the room. Between Ricky and Terry, the middle son. Between Terry and Daryl, the youngest one. Three sons from his own wife. And then there's Roxy. She knows why she's been living with her granny this past year and not with them. Half in and half out. That's what she is. Not in enough to have over for Sunday lunch, but not out enough to leave out of something like this. Something like this involves all of them. Roxy says, "We should kill him." Terry laughs. His dad gives him a look, and the laugh cuts off halfway through a breath. You don't want to mess with Bernie Monk. Not even if you're his full-born son.
"She's right," says Bernie. "You're right, Roxy. We should probably kill him. But he's strong and he's got a lot of friends and we need to go slow and careful. If we do it, we're going to do it just the once. Knock everything out in one go."
They get her to show them what she can do. She holds back a bit, gives each of them a dead arm in turn. Daryl swears when she touches him and she feels a bit sorry. Daryl's the only one who's always been nice to her. He brought her an extra chocolate mouse from the sweet shop whenever his dad took him over to her mum's after school. After she's finished, Bernie rubs his big arm and says, "That all you can do?" So she shows them. She's seen stuff on the internet. They follow her out into the garden, where Bernie's wife Barbara has one of them ornamental ponds full of big orange fish swimming around and around each other. It's cold. Roxy's feet crunch on the frost-crisp grass. She kneels down and puts the tips of her fingers into the pond. There's a smell, suddenly, like ripe fruit, sweet and succulent, The smell of high summer. A flicker of light in the dark water. A sound like a hiss and a crackle. And one by one, the fish bob up to the surface of the water.
Fuck, says Terry. Bloody hell, says Ricky. Mum's gonna be pissed off, says Daryl.
Barbara Monk never came to see Roxy. Not after her mother died, not after the funeral, nothing. Roxy's glad for a moment, thinking of her coming back to see all her fish dead.
I'll deal with your mother, says Bernie. We can use this, Rox Margill.
Bernie finds a couple of his blokes who've got daughters about the right age, gets them to show what they can do too. They do play fighting, sparring each against each, or two against one. Bernie watches them in the garden, sparking and flickering. All over the world, people are going crazy about this thing. But a few people always look at anything and go, where's the profit in this? And where's the advantage? One thing's certain, after the sparring matches and practice bouts, Roxy's got a lot of it. Not just more than average, more than any of the other girls they can find to practice with her. She learns a few things about radius and reach, about how to make it arc, and how it works better on wet skin. She feels proud of how strong she is. She puts everything into that. She's the strongest one they've found, out of all the girls they've heard of. That's why, when it comes time, when Bernie's arranged the whole thing and they know just where Primrose is going to be, that's why Roxy comes along too. Ricky pulls her into the loo before they leave. You're a big girl now, right, Rox? She nods. She knows about this. Kind of. He pulls a little plastic bag out from his pocket and tap some white powder onto the side of the sink. You've seen this before, haven't you?
Yeah.
Ever done it before? She shakes her head. Okay, then. He shows her how to do it, with a rolled-up 50 from his wallet, and tells her she can keep the note when they're done, perks of the job. She feels very clear and very clean when they've done it. It's not that she's forgotten what happened to her mum. Her anger is still pure and white and electric. But she doesn't feel the sadness of it at all. It's just a thing she heard about once. It's good. She is powerful. She has this whole day in her fingers. She lets a long arc go between the palms of her hands, loud and sparking, a longer arc than she's ever managed before.
Whoa! Says Ricky. Not in here, all right?
She brings it down and leaves it glittering around the pads of her fingers. It makes her want to laugh, how much she has and how easy it is to set it loose. He tips a little bit of the powder into a clean bag and pops it into her jeans pocket, just in case you need it. Don't do it unless you get scared, okay? Don't do it in the car, for Christ's sake. She doesn't need it. Everything belongs to her anyway. The next few hours are shutter snaps, pictures like on her phone. She blinks, and there's a picture. Blinks again, and there's something else. She looks at her watch, and it's 2 p.m. Looks a moment later, and it's 1:30. She couldn't worry about anything if she tried. It's good. They've drilled her in the plan. Primrose is going to be there with just two blokes. Weinstein, his mate, has sold him out. Brought him to this warehouse saying he needs to have a meeting. Bernie and his boys will be waiting behind some of the packing cases with the guns. Two of the boys will be outside to close the doors, seal them in. Take them by surprise. Let her rip. All done and home in time for tea. Primrose won't expect it. Roxy's only really coming along because she deserves to see it happen, after what she's been through. And because Bernie's always been a belt and braces man, that's how he survived as long as he has. So she's hiding upstairs in the warehouse, with a peephole view down through the grating of the upper level, surrounded by boxes, just in case. She's there, looking down, when Primrose arrives. Shutter open, shutter closed. When it goes down, it's quick and deadly, and a complete clusterfuck. Bernie and the boys are downstairs. They shout to Weinstein to get out of the way, and Weinstein does this thing, this shrug, like he's trying to say, "Hard luck, mate, hard cheese." But he ducks down anyway as Bernie and his sons advance, and that's when Primrose starts smiling. And his blokes come in. So many more of them than Weinstein said he'd have here. Someone's fucking lied. Click goes the shutter. Primrose is a tall man, thin and pale. There's 20 of his blokes here if there's one. They're firing, scattered around the entrance to the building, using iron half doors up against the rails for cover. There are just more of them than Bernie's men. Three of them have Terry pinned down behind a single wooden crate. Big, slow Terry with his huge, white, acne-marked forehead. And as Roxy watches, he peeps his head out from behind the box. "Shouldn't do that," she tries to shout, but nothing comes out. Primrose aims carefully, taking all the time in the world over it. He's smiling as he does it. And then there's a red hole in the middle of Terry's face, and he falls forward like a felled tree. Roxy looks at her hands. There are long electrical arcs passing between them, even though she doesn't think she ever told them to do that. She should do something. She feels afraid. She's only 15. She pulls the little packet out of her jeans and sniffs up some more of the powder. She sees the energy running along her arms and hands. She thinks, and it's like a voice outside her whispering in her ear, "You are made for this." She's on an iron walkway. It's connected to the metal half doors downstairs, which Primrose's men are using for cover. There's a lot of them down there, touching the iron or leaning against it. She sees what she can do all in a flash, and it makes her so excited she can barely sit still. Her one knee starts jiggling. This is it. These are the men who killed her mum, and now she knows what to do. She waits until one's resting his fingertips on the rail, and one's leaning his head against it, and a third's clutching onto a handle to lean down low to fire. One of them gets off a shot that hits Bernie in the side. Roxy breathes out slowly through pursed lips. "You've had this coming," she thinks. She lights up the rail. Three of them go down, backs arching, crying out, fitting and gnashing and eyes rolled back. "Gotcha. You asked for it." And then they spot her. Freeze frame. There aren't many of them left now. They're evenly matched. Maybe Bernie's even got the upper hand, especially because Primrose is a bit scared now. You can see it on his face. There's thundering steps on the iron stairs, and two blokes try to grab her. One of them leans close to her, because that's scary to normal kids, to any little girl, and it's just instinct. But she only has to put a couple of fingers to his temple and let a jolt go across his forehead, and he's fallen to the floor crying bloody tears. The other one grabs around the waist. "Don't they know anything?" And she gets his wrist. She's learning it doesn't take much to stop them touching her. And she feels pleased with herself, until she looks down and sees Primrose heading out the door that leads to the back of the block. He's going to get away. Bernie is moaning on the floor and Terry's bleeding from the hole in his head. Terry's gone, just like her mum. She's sure of that. But Primrose is trying to get away. "Oh, no, you're not, you little shit," Roxy thinks. "Oh, no, you're bloody not." She sprints down the steps, keeping low, and follows Primrose back through the building along a corridor through an empty open-plan office. She sees him veering left and she speeds up. If he gets to his car, she'll have lost him, and he'll come back on them hard and fast. He won't leave any of them alive. She thinks of his men taking her mum by the throat. He ordered this. He made it come true. Her legs pump harder. He goes down another corridor into a room. There's a door to the fire exit stairs, and she hears the handle go, and she's saying, "Fuck, fuck, fuck," to herself. But when she hurls her body round the corner, Primrose is still in that room. The door was locked, wasn't it? He's got hold of a metal bin, and he's bashing at the window to break it. And she dives down just like they'd practiced, slides and aims for his shin. Her one hand grasps his ankle, sweet bare flesh, and she gives it to him. He doesn't make a sound the first time. He topples to the ground like his knees given way, even while his arms are still trying to bash the window with that bin so it clangs into the wall. And as he goes down, she grabs his wrist and she gives it to him again. She can tell from the way he screams that no one's done this to him before. It's not the pain. It's the surprise. The horror. She sees the line run up his arm, just like on the bloke in her mum's house. And thinking of that, even remembering it, makes it run stronger and hotter through her. He screams like there are spiders under his skin, like they're biting him inside his flesh. She eases off a bit. "Please!" he says. "Please!" He looks at her, makes his swimming eyes focus. "I know you," he says. "Your mum's kid. Your mum was Christina, wasn't she?" He's not supposed to say her mum's name. He shouldn't do that. She gets him across the throat and he screams, and then he's saying, "Fuck, fuck, fuck!" And then he's gabbling. "I'm sorry about it. I am sorry. It was about your dad, but I can help you. You can come and work for me, brown girl like you. Strong girl like you. Never felt anything like it. Bernie doesn't want you around. I can tell you that. Come and work for me. Tell me what you want. I can get it for you." Roxy says, "You killed my mum." He goes, "Your dad killed three of my boys that month." She goes, "You sent your men and they killed my mum." And Primrose goes so quiet. So quiet and so still. She thinks he's going to start screaming again any second, or he's going to launch himself at her, teeth first. Then he smiles and shrugs. He says, "I've got nothing for you, love, if this is the way it is. But you were never supposed to see it. Newland said you weren't going to be home." Someone's coming up the stairs. She hears them. Feet. More than one pair. Boots on the stairs. Could be her dad's men, could be Primrose's. Could be she'll have to run or there'll be a bullet for her any second. "I was home, though," Roxy says. "Please," says Primrose. "Please, don't." And she's back there again. Clean and clear and with the crystals exploding in her brain, back in her mum's house. It was just what her mum said. Just that. She thinks of her dad with his rings on and his knuckles coming away from a man's mouth dripping blood. This is the only thing worth having. She puts her hand to Primrose's temples, and she kills him. Tunde. He gets a phone call the day after he puts the video online. It's from CNN, they say. He thinks they're kidding. It's just the kind of thing his friend Charles would do, some stupid joke. He called Tunde once, pretending to be the French ambassador. Kept up the snooty accent for 10 minutes before he cracked. The voice on the other end of the line says, "We want the rest of the video. We're happy to pay whatever you're asking." He says, "What? Is this Tunde Bourdillon Boy 97? "Yeah. It's CNN calling. We want to buy the rest of the video you put online of the incident in the grocery store and any others you have." And he thinks, "The rest? The rest?" And then he remembers. It's only missing a minute or two at the end. Other people came into the shot. I didn't think it was. We'll blur the faces. How much are you asking? His face is still pillow-mashed, and his head hurts. He throws out the first stupid number that comes into his head. $5,000. And they agree so fast that he knows he should have asked for double. That weekend, he prowls the streets and the clubs looking for footage. A fight between two women on the beach at midnight. The electricity lighting up the eager faces of their audience as the women grunt and struggle to grab each other's faces, throats. Tunde gets chiaroscuro shots of their faces, twisted with rage, half hidden in shadow. The camera makes him feel powerful, as if he's there, but not there. "You do what you like," he thinks to himself. "But I'm the one who's going to turn it into something. I'll be the one who'll tell the story." There's a girl and a boy making love in a back alley. She coaxes him with a crackling hand at the small of his back. The boy turns around to see Tunde's camera pointing at him and pauses, and the girl sends a flicker across his face and says, "Don't look at him. Look at me." When they're getting close, The girl smiles and lights up the boy's spine and says to Tunde,
"Hey, you are some too."
That's when he notices a second woman watching from further down the alley, and he runs as fast as he can, hearing them laughing behind him. Once he's safely out of the way, he laughs too. He looks at the footage on the screen. It's sexy. He'd like someone to do that to him, maybe. Maybe. CNN take those pieces of footage too. They pay. He looks at the money in his account, thinks, "I'm a journalist. This is all it means. I found the news and they paid me for it." His parents say, "When are you going back to school?" And he says, "I'm taking a semester off. Practical experience." This is his life. Starting. He can feel it. He learns early on not to use his cell phone camera. 3 times in the first few weeks, a woman touches the camera and the thing goes dead. He buys a box full of cheap digital cameras from a truck in Alaba Market. He knows he's not going to make the kind of money he wants, the kind of money he knows is out there, from footage he can take in Lagos. He reads internet forums discussing what's happening in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Russia. He can feel the excitement tingling up his spine. This is it. His war. His revolution. His history. Right here, hanging off the tree for anyone to pick. Charles and Joseph call him up to see if he wants to go to a party on Friday night, and he laughs and says, "I've got bigger plans, man." He buys a plane ticket. He arrives in Riyadh on the night of the first great riot. This is his luck. If he'd turned up 3 weeks before, he might have run out of money or enthusiasm too early. He'd have got the same footage as everyone else. Women wearing the betula, practicing their sparks on each other, giggling shyly. More likely, he would have got nothing. Those shots were mostly filmed by women. To be a man, filming here, he needed to arrive on the night that they swarmed through the city. It had been sparked by the death of 2 girls, about 12 years old. An uncle had found them practicing their devilry together. A religious man, he had summoned his friends, and the girls had struggled against their punishment, and somehow they had both ended up beaten to death. And the neighbours saw and heard. And who can say why these things happen on Thursday, when the same events might have gone unremarked on Tuesday? They fought back. 12 women turned into 100, 100 into 1,000. The police retreated. The women shouted. Some made placards. They understood their strength, all at once. When Tunde arrives at the airport, the security officers at the doors tell him it's not safe to leave, that foreign visitors should stay here in the terminal and take the first flight home. He has to bribe 3 separate men to sneak out. He pays a cab driver double to take him where the women are gathering, shouting and marching. It is the middle of the day, and the man is frightened. "Go home," he says, as Tunde jumps from the cab, and Tunde cannot tell whether he's saying what he's about to do or giving advice. 3 streets away, he spots the tail of the crowd. He has a feeling something will happen here today, something he has not seen before. He is too excited to be afraid. He is going to be the one to record this thing. He follows behind them, holding his camera close to his body so it won't be too obvious what he's doing. But still, a couple of the women notice him. They shout at him, first in Arabic and then in English.
"News? CNN? BBC?"
"Yes," he says, "CNN. They start to laugh, and for a moment he is afraid. But it passes like a wisp of cloud when they shout to one another, "CNN! CNN!" And more women come, holding their thumbs up and smiling into the camera.
"You cannot walk with us, CNN," says one of them, her English a little better than the others. "There will be no men with us today."
"Oh, but," Tunde smiles his broad and winning smile. "I'm harmless. You wouldn't hurt me." The women say,
"No, no men, no."
"What do I have to do to convince you you can trust me?" says Tunde. "Look, here's my CNN badge. I'm not carrying any weapons." He opens up his jacket, takes it off slowly, swirls it in the air to show both sides. The women are watching him. The one whose English is better says,
"You could be carrying anything."
"What's your name?"
he says.
"You know mine already. I'm at a disadvantage."
"Nur," she says. "It means light. We are the ones who bring the light. Now, tell us, what if you have a gun in a holster on your back or a taser strapped to your cuff?"
He looks at her, raises an eyebrow. She has dark, laughing eyes. She's laughing at him.
"Really?"
he says. She nods, smiling. He unbuttons his shirt slowly, peels it off his back. There are sparks flying between their fingertips, but he is not afraid.
"No gun taped to my back."
"I see that," she says. "Cuff?"
There are maybe 30 women watching this now. Any one of them could kill him with a single blow.
"In for a penny?"
He undoes his jeans, slips them down. There's a little intake of breath around the crowd of women. He turns in a slow circle.
"No taser," says Tunde, "on my cuff."
Noor smiles, licks her top lip.
"Then you should come with us, CNN. Put your clothes back on and follow."
He pulls his clothes on hastily and stumbles behind them. She reaches for him and takes his left hand.
"In our country, it is forbidden for a man and a woman to hold hands in the street. In our country, a woman is not allowed to drive a car. Women are no good with cars."
She squeezes his hand more tightly. He can feel the crackle of power across her shoulders, like the feeling in the air before a storm. She does not hurt him. Not even a flicker of it leaks into him. She pulls him across the empty road to a shopping mall. Outside the entrance, dozens of cars are parked in orderly rows, marked out by red and green and blue flags. In the upper floors of the mall, Tunde sees some men and women watching. The young women around him laugh and point at them, and make a crackle pass between their fingertips. The men flinch. The women stare hungrily. Their eyes are parched for the sight of it. Noor laughs as she makes Tunde stand well back from the bonnet of a black jeep parked right outside the entrance. Her smile is wide and confident.
"Are you recording?"
she says.
"Yes." "They do not let us drive a car here," she says. "But watch what we can do."
She puts her palm flat on the bonnet. There is a click, and it flicks open. She grins at him. She places her hand, just so, upon the engine, next to the battery. The engine kicks on. The car revs. Higher and higher, louder and louder, the motor thudding and screeching, the whole machine trying to escape from her. Noor is laughing as she does it. The noise becomes louder, the sound of an engine in agony, and then a vast, explosive percussion, a great white light out of the engine block, and the whole thing melts, warps down into the tarmac, dripping with oil and hot steel. She grimaces, grabs Tunde's hand and shouts, "Run!" in his ear, and they do. They run across the parking lot, while she says, "Look, film it, film it!" And he turns back towards the jeep, just at the moment that the hot metal hits the fuel line and the whole thing explodes. It is so loud and hot that for a moment his camera screen goes white and then black. And when the picture comes back, there are young women advancing across the center of the screen, each of them backed by the fire, each of them walking with the lightning. They are going from car to car, setting the motors revving, and the engine blocks burning into a molten heat. Some of them can do it without touching the cars. They send their lines of power out from their bodies, and they are all laughing. Tunde pans up to look at the people watching from the windows to see what they are doing. There are men trying to drag their women from the glass, and there are women shrugging off their hands, not bothering to say a word, watching and watching. Palms pressed against the glass. He knows then that this thing is going to take the world, and everything will be different. And he is so glad he shouts for joy, whooping with the others among the flames. In Manfua, to the west of the city, an elderly Ethiopian woman walks out of a half-built, scaffold-supported building into the street to greet them, her hands held high, calling out something that none of them can understand. Her back is bent, her shoulders hunched forward, her spine humped between her shoulder blades. Noor takes her palm between her two hands, and the older woman watches her like a patient observing a doctor's treatment. Noor puts two fingers to her palm and shows her how to use the thing that must always have been in her, must have been waiting all the years of her life to emerge. This is how it works. The younger women can wake it up in the older ones, but from now on, all women will have it. The older woman starts to cry when the gentle force of it wakes up the lines of her nerves and ligaments. You can see it in her face on the footage, when she feels it inside her. She does not have much to give. A tiny spark jumps between her fingertips and Noor's arm. She must be 80 years old, and the tears run down her face as she does it again and again. She holds up her two palms and starts to ululate. The other women take it up, and the street is filled with the sound. The city is filled with it. The country, Tunde thinks, must be full of this joyful warning. He is the only man here, the only one filming. This revolution feels like his personal miracle, a thing to overturn the world. He travels with them through the night and records the things he sees. In the north of the city, they see a woman in an upstairs room behind a barred window. She drops a note down through the bars. Tunde cannot get close enough to read it, but there is a ripple through the crowd as the message is passed from person to person. They break down the door, and he follows them as they find the man who has been holding her prisoner cowering in a kitchen cupboard. They do not even bother to hurt him. They take the woman with them as they gather and grow. In the campus of the Health Sciences Department, a man runs towards them, firing an army rifle and shouting in Arabic and English about their offence against their betters. He wounds three of the women in the leg or arm, and the others are on him like a tide. There is a sound like eggs frying. When Tunde gets close enough to show what has been done, he is perfectly still. The twisted vine marks across his face and neck so thick that his features are barely discernible. At last, near dawn, crowded around by women who show no signs of tiring, Noor takes his hand and leads him to an apartment, a room, a bed. It belongs to a friend of hers, she says, a student. Six people live here, but half the city has fled now, and the place is empty. The electricity isn't working. She makes a spark in her hand to find their way. And there, in the flash of her, she takes off his jacket, pulls his shirt over his head. She looks at his body as she did before, open and hungry. She kisses him. "I have never done this before," she says. And he tells her the same is true for him. And he does not feel ashamed. She puts her palm to his chest. "I am a free woman," she says. He feels it. It is exhilarating. In the streets there are still shouts and crackles and sporadic sounds of gunfire. Here, in a bedroom covered with posters of pop singers and movie stars, their bodies are warm together. She unbuttons his jeans and he steps out of them. She goes carefully. He can feel her skein starting to hum. He is afraid. He is turned on. It is all bundled up together, as it is in his fantasies.
"You are a good man," she says. "You are beautiful."
She runs the back of her hand over the sparse fur of his chest. She lets a tiny crackle go, a prickle at his hair's ends, glowing faintly. It feels good. Every line of his body is coming into focus as she touches him, as if he hadn't really been there at all before. He wants to be inside her. His body is already telling him what to do, how to move this thing forward, how to take her arms, how to bring her down onto the bed, how to consummate. But the body has contradictory impulses. Fear is as significant as lust. Physical pain as strong as desire. He holds himself there, wanting and not wanting. He lets her set the pace. It takes a long while, and it is good. She shows him what to do with his mouth and with his fingers. By the time she is riding him, sweating and calling out, the sun has risen on a new day in Riyadh. And when she loses control as she finishes, she sends a jolt through his buttocks and across his pelvis, and he barely feels the pain at all, so great is the delight. Later that afternoon, they send out the men in helicopters and soldiers on the streets, armed with guns and live ammunition. Tunde is there to film it when the women hit back. There are so many of them. They are so numerous and so angry. Several women are killed, but this just sharpens the rest. And can any soldier keep on firing forever, mowing down row after row of women? The women fuse the firing pins inside the barrels. They cook the electronics of the vehicles. They do it happily. "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive," says Tunde in his voiceover report, because he's been reading about revolution. "But to be young was very heaven." 12 days later, the government has fallen. There are rumors, never substantiated, about who killed the king. Some say it was a member of the family, and some say it was an Israeli assassin, and some whisper that it was one of the maids who had served in the palace loyally for years, feeling the power between her fingertips and no longer able to hold it back. By that time, anyway, Tunde is on a plane again. What has happened in Saudi Arabia has been seen across the world, and the thing is happening everywhere, all at once now. Margot. "It's a problem. We all know it's a problem. Think about it, Margot. I mean, really think about it. I am thinking about it. We've got no way to know whether anyone in this room can do it. We know you couldn't do it, Daniel." That gets a laugh. In a room of anxious people, a laugh is a release. It wells up to more than its proper size. It takes a few moments for the 23 people gathered around the conference table to settle again. Daniel is upset. He thinks it's a joke about him. He's always wanted just a little bit more than his due. "Obviously," he says. "Obviously. But we have no way to know. The girls, fine. We're doing what we can with them. God, have you seen the numbers on runaways?" They've all seen the numbers on runaways. Daniel presses on. "I'm not talking about the girls. We've got that under control, for the most part. I'm talking about grown women. Teenage girls can wake this thing up in older women, and they can give it to each other. Grown women can do it now, Margot. You've seen that stuff."
"It's very rare."
"We think it's very rare. What I'm saying is, we just don't know. It could be you, Stacy, or you, Marisha. For all we know, Margot, you might be able to do it yourself."
He laughs, and that also gets a nervous little ripple. Margot says,
"Sure, Daniel. I could zap you right now. The governor's office treads on a new cycle you agreed to give to the mayoralty." She makes a gesture, splaying her fingers wide. "Vzzt." "I don't think that's funny, Margot."
But the other people around the table are already laughing. Daniel says,
"We're going to get this test. Bring it in statewide, all government employees. That includes the mayor's office, Margot. No arguments. We need to know for sure. You can't have someone employed in government buildings who can do that. It's like walking around with a loaded gun."
It's been a year. There's been footage on the TV of riots in faraway and unstable parts of the world, of women taking whole cities. Daniel's right. The critical thing isn't that 15-year-old girls can do it. You could contain that. The thing is that they can wake up this power in some of the older women. It raises questions. How long has this been possible? How did no one know until now? On the morning shows, they bring in experts on human biology and prehistoric images. This carved image found in Honduras, dating back more than 6,000 years. Doesn't that look like a woman with lightning coming from her hands to you, Professor? Well, of course, these carvings often represent mythical and symbolic behaviors. But it could be historical, that is, it could represent something that actually happened. It could, maybe. Did you know, in the oldest text, that the god of the Israelites had a sister, Anath, a teenage girl? Did you know that she was the warrior? That she was invincible? That she spoke with the lightning? That in the oldest texts, she killed her own father and took his place? She liked to bathe her feet in the blood of her enemies. The TV anchors laugh uneasily. That doesn't sound like much of a beauty regime now, does it, Kristen? Certainly does not, Tom. But now this destroying goddess. Do you think those ancient peoples knew something we don't? It's hard to say, of course. And is it possible that this capacity goes back a very long time? You mean, women in the past could do it too, and we forgot? Seems like a hell of a thing to forget now, doesn't it? How could it have been forgotten? Well now, Kristen, if a power like this existed, maybe we bred it out deliberately. Maybe we didn't want it around. You'd tell me if you could do something like that, wouldn't you, Kristen? Well, you know, Tom, maybe I'd want to keep a thing like that to myself. The news anchor's eyes meet. Something unspoken passes between them. And now the weather on the ones. The official line for now from the mayor's office, handed out on photocopied sheets to schools across the major metropolitan area, is abstinence. Just don't do it. It'll pass. We keep the girls separate from the boys, there'll be an injection within a year or two to stop this thing happening, and then we'll all go back to normal. It's as upsetting for the girls to use it as it is for their victims. That's the official line. Late at night, in a part of town she knows has no surveillance cameras, Margot parks her car, gets out, puts her palm to a lamppost, and gives it everything she's got. She just needs to know what she's got under the hood here. She wants to feel what it is. It feels as natural as anything she's ever done. As known and understood as the first time she had sex. As her body saying, hey, I got this. All the lights in the road go out. Pop, pop, pop. Margot laughs out loud, there in the silent street. She'd be impeached if anyone found out, but then she'd be impeached anyway if anyone knew she could do it at all, so what's the margin? She guns the gas and drives off before the sirens start. She wondered what she'd have done if they'd caught her. And in the asking, she knows she has enough left in her skein to stun a man, at least, maybe more. Can feel the power sloshing across her collarbone and up and down her arms. The thought makes her laugh again. She finds she's doing that more often now. Just laughing. There's a sort of constant ease, as if it's high summer all the time inside her. It hasn't been this way with Joss. No one knows why. No one's done enough research on the thing even to venture a suggestion. She's getting fluctuations. Some days she's got so much power in her that she trips the house fuse box just turning on a light. Some days she has nothing. Not even enough to defend herself if some girl picks a fight with her in the street. There are nasty names now for a girl who can't or won't defend herself. Blanket, they call them, and flat battery. Those are the least offensive ones. Gimp, flick, nesh, bzzzt. The last, apparently, for the sound of a woman trying to make a spark and failing. For maximum effect, you need a group of girls all innocuously whispering, bzzzt, as you walk past. Young people are still deadly. Joss has been spending more and more time alone. As her friends find, new friends, with whom they have more in common. Margot suggests that Jocelyn come to stay by herself one weekend. She'll have Joss, Bobby will take Maddie. It's nice for the girls to have a parent all to themselves. Maddie wants to take the bus into town to look at the dinosaurs. She never gets to take the bus anymore. It's more of a treat for her now than the museum. Margot's been working so hard. I'll take Joss for mani-pedis, she says. It'll be good for both of us to take a break. They eat breakfast at the table by the kitchen's glass wall. Joss helps herself to some more stewed plums from the bowl and tops them with yogurt. And Margot says, "You still can't tell anyone."
"Yeah, I know."
"I could lose my job if you tell anyone."
"Mom, I know. I haven't told Dad and I haven't told Maddie. I haven't told anyone."
"I won't."
"I'm sorry."
Jocelyn smiles.
"It's cool."
Margot suddenly remembers how much she would have liked to have a secret to share with her mother. How the yearning for it made even the grubby rituals of elasticated bands for sanitary towels or carefully concealed leg razors seem faintly lovable or even glamorous. They practice together, in the garage in the afternoon, challenging each other, fighting and working up a little sweat. Joss's power gets stronger and easier to control if she works with it. Margot can feel it flickering. Feel that it hurts Joss when the power rises up and then suddenly shorts out. There must be some way Joss can learn to control it. There must be girls in her own metropolitan area's schools who've had to learn to control it themselves and could teach Joss a few tricks. As for Margot, all she needs to know is that she can keep it under control. They're bringing in testing at work.
"Come on in, Mayor Cleary. Sit down."
The room is small, and there is only one tiny window far up near the ceiling, letting in a thin strip of grey light. When the nurse visits for the annual flu shot, this is the room she uses, or if someone's doing the staff review. There's a table and three chairs. Behind the table is a woman wearing a bright blue security tag pinned to her lapel. On top of the table is a piece of machinery. It looks like it might be a microscope or a blood testing apparatus. There are two needles and a focusing window and lenses. The woman says,
"We want you to know, Madam Mayor, that everyone in the building is being tested. You haven't been singled out."
"Even the man?"
Margot raises an eyebrow. "Well, no, not the man."
Margot thinks about that. "Okay.
And it's
what
exactly?"
The woman gives a faint smile.
"Madam Mayor, you signed the papers. You know what this is."
She feels her throat constrict. She puts one hand on her hip.
"No, actually, I want you to tell me what it is, for the record."
The woman wearing the security tag says,
"It's a statewide mandatory testing for the presence of a skein or the electrostatic power."
She starts to read from a card sitting next to the machine.
"Please be advised that following a statewide order from the Governor Daniel Danden, your continued eligibility for your government position is dependent on your agreement to be tested. A positive test result need not necessarily have any bearing on your future employment. It is possible for a woman to test positive without knowing that she has the capacity to use the electrostatic power. Counseling is available if the results of this test are distressing to you or to help you consider your options if your current position is no longer suitable."
"What does that mean?" says Margot. "No longer suitable. What does it mean?" The woman purses her lips.
"Certain positions involving contact with children and the public have been mandated as unsuitable by the governor's office."
It's like Margot can see Daniel Danden, the governor of this great state, standing behind the woman's chair, laughing.
"Children and the public? What does that leave me?"
The woman smiles.
"If you haven't experienced the power yet, it's all going to be fine. Nothing to worry about. On with your day."
"It's not fine for everyone." The woman flicks a switch on the machine. It starts up a gentle hum.
"I'm ready to begin, Madam Mayor."
"What happens if I say no?" She sighs.
"If you say no, I'll have to record it. and the governor will inform someone in the State Department.
Margot sits down. She thinks, they won't be able to tell I've used it. No one knows. I haven't been lying. She thinks, shit. She swallows.
Fine, she says. I'd like it recorded that I'm making a formal protest about being forced to undergo invasive testing.
Okay,
says the woman. I'll get that written down.
And behind her faint smirk, Margot can see Daniel's face again, laughing. She puts her arm out for the electrodes, thinking that at least after this is done, even after she's out of a job and there go her political ambitions, at least then she won't have to look at his stupid face any more. They apply the sticky electrode pads to her wrists, her shoulders, her collarbone. They're looking for electrical activity, the technician explains in a low droning voice.
You should be perfectly comfortable, ma'am. At worst, you'll experience a slight stinging sensation.
At worst, I'll experience the end of my career, Margot thinks, but says nothing. It's all very simple. They're going to trigger her autonomic nervous function with a series of low-level electrical impulses. It works on the girl babies in routine tests now being run in hospitals, even though the answer is always the same, because all the girl babies have it now. Every single one. Give them an almost imperceptible shock across the skein. The skein will respond automatically with a jolt. Margot can feel her skein is ready anyway. It's the nerves. The adrenaline. Remember to look surprised, she says to herself. Remember to look afraid and ashamed and taken aback by this brand new thing. The machine makes a low, buzzing hum as it starts. Margot is familiar with the schematics. It will begin by giving an entirely imperceptible shock, too low for the senses to register. The skeins of those little baby girls almost always respond at this level. Or the next one. The machine has 10 settings. The electrical stimulus will increase level by level. At a certain point, Margot's own aged and unpracticed skein will respond, like calling to like. And then they will know. She breathes in. She breathes out. She waits. At the start, she cannot feel it at all. There is simply the sensation of pressure building. Across her chest. Down her spine. She does not feel the first level, or the second level, or the third, as the machine clicks smoothly through its cycle. The dial moves on. Margot feels that it would be pleasant, now, to discharge herself. It is like the feeling on waking that one might like to open one's eyes. She resists. It is not difficult. She breathes in. She breathes out. The woman operating the machine smiles, makes a note on her Xerox sheet of boxes. A fourth zero in the fourth box. Nearly halfway there. Of course, at some point it will become impossible. Margot has read it in the literature. She makes a rueful little smile at the technician.
Are you comfortable?
The woman says.
I'd be more comfortable with a glass of scotch, Margot says.
The dial clicks forward. Now, it is becoming more difficult. She feels the pricking at the right side of her collarbone and in the palm of her hand. Come on, it says. Come on. It is like a pressure holding her arm down now. Uncomfortable. She could so easily throw this heavy, pressing weight off and be free of it. But she cannot be seen to sweat, cannot show a struggle. Margot thinks of what she did when Bobby told her he'd been having an affair. She remembers how her body went hot and cold, how she felt her throat close up. She remembers how he said,
"Aren't you going to say anything? Don't you have anything to say about that?"
Her mother would scream at her father for leaving the door unlatched when he walked out in the morning,
or forgetting his slippers in the middle of the living room rug.
She's never been one of those women. Never wanted to be.
She used to walk in the cool of the yew trees when she was a child, placing each foot so carefully, pretending that if she took one wrong step, the roots would curl up through the earth and grab her. She has always known exactly how to be silent. The dial clicks on. There is a neat row of 8 zeros on the woman's Xeroxed sheet. Margot had been afraid she would not know what a zero felt like, that the business would be over before it began and she would have no choice. She breathes in and breathes out. It is hard now. Very hard. But the difficulty is familiar. Her body wants something, and she is denying it. The itch of it, the pressure of it, is across the front of her torso, down through the muscles of her stomach into her pelvis around her buttocks. It is like simply not passing water when your bladder asks you to. It is like holding your breath for a few seconds longer than is entirely comfortable. It is no wonder that baby girls can't do it. It's a wonder they found any adult women at all with this thing. Margot feels herself want to discharge and doesn't. Just doesn't. The machine clicks onto its 10th setting. It is not impossible. Not even nearly. She waits. The humming cuts off. The fans whir and then are silent. The pen lifts from the graph table. 10 zeros. Margot tries to look disappointed. No dice, huh? The technician shrugs. Margot tucks one foot behind the other ankle as the technician removes the electrodes. I never thought I had it. She makes a voice crack, just a little at the end of the sentence. Daniel will look at this report. He'll be the one to sign off on it. Cleared, it will say, for government work. She twitches her shoulders and lets out a little barking laugh. And there's no reason now not to put her in charge of the program rolling out this test across the major metropolitan area. Not a reason in the world. She's the one who signs off on the budget for it, who agrees the informational campaigns explaining that this technology will keep our sons and daughters safe. It's Margot's name, when you come right down to it, on the official documentation saying that this testing equipment will help save lives. She tells herself, as she signs the forms, that it's probably true. Any woman who can't stop herself from discharging under this mild pressure is a danger to herself, and a danger, yes, to society. There are strange movements rising now, not only across the world, but right here in the US of A. You can see it on the internet. Boys dressing as girls to seem more powerful. Girls dressing as boys to shake off the meaning of the power, or to leap on the unsuspecting, wolf in sheep's clothing. The Westboro Baptist Church has seen a sudden influx of crazy new members who think the Day of Judgment is coming. The work they're doing right here, trying to keep everything normal, to keep people feeling safe and going to their jobs and spending their dollars on weekend recreational activities. This is important work. Daniel says,
I try. I really try always to have something positive to say, you know, but I just...
He lets the pages slip from his hand, fall across the table.
Your people haven't given me a single thing I can use here.
Arnold, Daniel's budget guy, nods silently, holding his chin in his hand, an awkward, twisted gesture.
I know, it's not your fault,
says Daniel.
You're understaffed, under-resourced, we all know you're trying your hardest in difficult circumstances, but this just isn't something we can use.
Margot has read the report from the mayor's office. It's bold, yes. It suggests a strategy of radical openness about the current state of protection, of treatments, of the potential for any future reversal. The potential is nil. Daniel keeps on talking, listing one problem after another, never quite saying, "I'm not brave enough for this," but meaning that every time. Margot's hands are flat against the underside of the table, palms upward. She feels the fizz building as he speaks. She breathes very slowly and evenly. She knows she can control this. It's the control that gives her pleasure. At first. She thinks of exactly what she would do. As Daniel drones on, she can feel it out quite simply. She has enough power within her to take Daniel's throat in her grip and pinch him out with one blast. She'd have plenty left to deliver Arnold a blow to the temple, knock him cold at least.